Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today we're going to talk about a very important topic that's very much in the news these days because of the wars in the Middle East, and that is brain injury and how to recover from brain injury. An injury to the brain can be sustained in a number of different ways. You can have a sports accident. You can have an encounter with a roadside bomb in the Middle East. You can have an automobile accident. You could have brain surgery or a stroke. Any of those may injure the brain. And one of the issues is that you don't sport a cast. You know, you don't have a cast on your leg that everybody can sign and give you the appropriate level of sympathy. It's a kind of silent injury. You walk around looking perfectly able, but in fact you're not so able, and you do need some TLC to get over this. So we have a very special guest with us today to talk about brain injury and recovery from brain injury, and we'll be talking with her in just a moment. I wanted to remind you first that this program is brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. Von Hippel-Lindau disease is a hereditary cancer syndrome, and one of the many things that can happen to you with the VHL syndrome is brain tumors, and so we're very interested in this topic for that perspective. But of course, as I said before, there are many, many people who will have an encounter with brain injury at some point in your life, even if you like fall down the stairs or get knocked out on the football field. So we all need to pay attention to this and the very insidious things that it can do to our brains that are not clear and obvious. Let me play you a little bit of information first about von Hippel-Lindau disease. We hope you'll check out the website and help us to cure VHL, and we'll be back in just a minute to introduce our guest.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Thanks very much for listening. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest this week. It's Janet Cromer, the author of a book called Professor Cromer Learns to Read, A Couple's New Life After Brain Injury. Welcome, Janet.
Thank you very much, Joyce. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. So tell me about Professor Cromer Learns to Read. This is your husband had an injury?
That's right. In 1998, my husband, Alan, who was a professor at Northeastern University at the time, a physics professor, had a massive heart attack, and his heart stopped, and it took 45 minutes to resuscitate him before he came back to life. He was left with a severe brain injury from lack of oxygen. And in an instant, as always happens with brain injury, Alan went from being a prolific author and speaker to needing to learn to read, write, walk, talk, think, remember all over again. He did have 3 months of intensive brain injury rehabilitation at Spalding Rehab Hospital in Boston. And then he and I did cognitive rehabilitation at home for years after that. He continued to make progress steadily for 3 years after the brain injury, but we needed to start a whole new life, and he needed a new identity and ways of finding purpose in life.
Right. It's really amazing that, as you say, in an instant, life just kind of resets.
That's right. It's like a door slams on your old life when you have a moderate to severe injury. And a new door opens, but the horizon looks pretty vast and unspecific for quite a while until you make your way into this new land.
Right. I know in the press release that you all put out, you had made reference to Gabrielle Giffords, the congresswoman who was shot. So similarly, in an instant, her life has completely changed. And,
That's right.
And her husband and the people around her.
That's right, exactly. Brain injury affects has a ripple effect, first on the immediate family, and as you specified, with the family that the disease that so affected your family, it starts with the immediate family, but then goes out to close friends, coworkers, the community, has quite a ripple effect.
Right, because even if the injury is minor, it's never minor
yes.
in the brain, but it just looks more minor. You walk and talk, and everything seems okay. Like when you get thrown down on the football field and
right,
you're knocked out for a minute
mm-hmm.
or two. And then, you know, your teenager or whoever it was who has this injury is walking around looking perfectly normal, but suddenly doesn't have the attention span for doing his homework, is not as responsive, and you think he's not trying. So the whole dynamics with everybody around him begins to shift.
That's right. I'm glad there's so much attention now to sports injuries. My goodness, you know, now we know they can have quite an impact for quite some time, and concussion can be treated very effectively if you take a break right away and do all the right things before you let someone play the sport again. But I'm glad we're getting so much attention to that because it can have long-term repercussions if it's not treated.
Right, so even that mild automobile accident or sports injury really does need the same kind of attention and care as we would give to someone with a stroke.
It needs a very careful evaluation by someone who's skilled in doing the evaluation and taking time out, which people often don't want to do. We want to get back to school, back to work. Sometimes you need to rest the brain for a long period of time to let it do the healing that it needs to do. And then if that doesn't happen, to have a more neuropsychological evaluation to find out what parts are affected. Is there a problem with reasoning or taking information in or calling up facts that you used to know? Very specific areas of the brain can be affected and then treated if you get the right treatment early.
Right. So where do you find someone who is particularly sensitive to these issues, more than your pediatrician or your GP?
One good source is the Brain Injury Association of America, which is BIAA.org, is their website, and there they have links to 40 state affiliates. Most states have a brain injury association now, and they keep lists of all the most skilled practitioners and programs that you could be referred to.
Right, and if you do wind up in the emergency room people are more on top of this these days than they ever have been before.
That's right. It's been such a big change in raising awareness and treatment and changing the culture around concussion also. That was a big part,
right.
Both in sports injuries and the battlefield, you know, changing the culture that you don't get to just jump right up and get back in there. You owe it to the team, you know. No, no, no.
Right, and I went looking for assistance for someone with a mild traumatic brain injury in Texas not too long ago, and I was amazed at how many treatment centers now are specializing in traumatic brain injury, and much of that's probably due to the war.
Yes, that's very true. You know, it's estimated that up to at least 300,000 service members are coming back with some degree of brain injury. You know, it is a continuum from what's called mild, the person who has
right.
it wouldn't say that, but mild to severe.
Mm-hmm.
So up to 300,000 service members, and many of them will need treatment, resources, vocational rehab for many, many years to come. And once they're back in the community especially, there's excellent systems set up by the VA and the Department of Defense now to treat people in the early stages and up to a year or two. But we're needing to develop many more services in the community, both for the wounded service members and for their family caregivers.
Right, and the key words, if someone needs to look up resources for this, is traumatic brain injury, or TBI. And sometimes it's mild traumatic brain injury, or MTBI. But Those are the things to look for on the internet. And as we said, you will find resources. How do we determine whether our loved one, whether it's a teenage with a sports injury or a returning veteran or an older person in the family, how do we determine whether they might need this kind of assistance?
Sometimes the signs of brain injury can be a little subtle at first, but if you know the person well, you'll probably notice them. They themselves might notice that they have trouble with a headache or blurry vision, or they're feeling nauseated, or they're sensitive to light or noise. You know, the TV's really driving them crazy and they don't want to be in the sunlight. Or they may feel more tired than they used to, so that's a change. You might notice that they're having a little problem with their memory. They're not thinking quite as clearly, or they're not concentrating. And it can also affect emotions, so the person often seems more irritable, and that's often because they're so frustrated by realizing that something's wrong, but they don't know what it is. So they may be more irritable or sad or anxious. They may sleep more or less than they used to, or have a lot of trouble with staying asleep. So there are a lot of subtle signs, but it's worth paying attention to them. And whether the person notices or you do, starting with a family doctor or an emergency room visit to get it checked out.
Right. I have a friend who owned a restaurant, and she fell down the narrow staircase going down to the basement storage area in her restaurant and lost her sense of taste.
Oh, yes.
There's no part of the brain that can't be affected for a restaurateur.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Well, my husband lost his sense of smell, so that affected his sense of taste. And before that, he used to love hot, spicy food. Well, afterwards, he couldn't stand it, and he'd say, take this away, it has too much taste, you know, but he lost his sense of smell.
Interesting. But we don't always think of it, but those are all actions that actually happen in the brain. We have the sort of data collection devices elsewhere, like on your tongue, you have all these little sensors, but they send the signals to the brain. It's the brain that's actually determining, is this salty or is this spicy or whatever. So these are all neurological deficits when you have disruptions of any of the senses.
That's right, and it can be a relatively small problem compared to a lot of the major problems, like needing to learn to read and write again or to reason out a common daily problem. But it's still one more thing, you know, that makes a person feel like, I'm not the same person I used to be, or this is one more thing to have to deal with.
Right, and as you say, it leads to a lot of frustration on the part of the injured person, the patient, if you will. But that leads to a lot of disruption of the normal interactions with people around them, and starting with one's parents or spouse.
Yes, that's true. Everybody needs to recognize that things have changed. Often things have changed quite a bit. And if someone has a moderate to severe brain injury, they may have personality changes. That happened with my husband, Alan. And at first I called him another Alan. I thought, this isn't the same person that I was married to. After he woke up from the coma, you know, he had a lot of problems with agitation. He didn't remember anything about our life together. He always had a sense I was his wife and wanted me there beside him, even before he regained language and could call me by name. But he had that sense. But at the same time, he had so many problems with his frontal lobe and temporal lobes of his brain that agitation was a major concern for quite some time. And that was not his usual personality or his before personality. So it takes a lot of patience to get to know who this new person is. And for them, imagine being the person with a brain injury who goes home with someone you barely know, and they're kind of running the show now and telling you everything you have to do and helping you remember, you know, when to eat and how to dress and how to walk down the street safely. So what kind of trust does that take? Enormous trust on both sides. But over time, even if someone's personality has changed, it's really helpful to identify some new characteristics that you respect and like about this person as you're starting to get to know each other again.
Right. And it's hard enough for couples in the military because, as you say, the person who's in the service has been over there for 2-3 years or something, and the spouse left at home has been having to run the family and
yes.
be the head of household, whether it's a woman or a man. And they, when this person comes back into the family circle, there are a set of expectations that they start out with, well, he's going to be like he used to be, and that's not working. So then, and he comes with a set of expectations that says, okay, so now I'm the head of household, and the previous head of household is feeling displaced. So,
right.
So there are all kinds of dynamics that work there even when everybody's healthy. And when one of these brains is a little bit out of kilter here, it becomes even more difficult.
That's exactly right. And you have to renegotiate everything that needs to be done, all the responsibilities that are shared or individual, and learn how to share control depending on what the person with the brain injury is capable of and can reasonably take on and meet everybody's safety needs, especially if there are young children in the family. When Alan came out of the hospital, he really couldn't be responsible for his own safety at all, no mind having him be responsible for anybody else's. So that's something the caregiver has to take on as an extra responsibility. And it helps a lot to, and we don't often get the time or put enough priority on this, to really stop and admit the changes that are going on and grieve the losses, especially if it looks like they're going to be longstanding or even permanent. And that can take a while to figure out because things change so much as the brain starts to heal itself or a person goes through rehab. There are just natural processes that go on. So that for the first months or year even, things are changing within the person with the brain injury, within the family caregiver and the other members of the family. But it's important to stop and just grieve the losses and changes that have gone on before you can really make a commitment to get to know and form a new relationship and work together with this new person.
That's very important. And taking that time to grieve it is something that we don't always give ourselves space to do. We think the macho man syndrome is you really ought to get over it, you know, get on with your life, get, as you said, get back with your team, whatever,
mm-hmm.
And not admit the injury. But in fact, that's counterproductive and can delay the healing. And the brain is not like a bone or something that'll heal in 6 or 8 weeks. It's not like a normal wound. It can take up to 2 years for a lot of this healing to happen.
That's right. And the good news that we're understanding more and more comes from this field of neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity means that the brain has quite an innate capacity to heal, especially with the right treatments, and that it can even rewire parts of the brain or train in one area that wasn't injured to take over some of the functions of an area that was. And this is
right.
This field is in its infancy, but it's so hopeful, and they're doing a lot with developments right now. But one of the best things is they used to say that if someone had a pretty severe brain injury, a year was it. Whatever progress you made at the end of the year, that was it. You'd probably be the same after that. Now we know that's not true at all. The brain can heal and retrain for years after the injury with the right kinds of cognitive rehabilitation particularly. But that's very hopeful. And even though Alan had such a severe injury, he made gains in language and reading, writing, and some reasoning skills for 3 years after the injury. Now, we worked on them at home every day for years, but that's very hopeful information.
Yes, and let me just reemphasize neuroplasticity. And we've talked about this on some shows in the past, but plasticity in the effect of like molding and shaping, almost what you would do with a piece of clay, that you can move it around, you can change it. The brain can do that to itself. And as you say, some other part of the brain might even take over a function that's injured. So the brain can rewire itself in that way. and say, okay, we need to tell that leg to move here, and if that part of the brain's not doing it, maybe I can get this other part of the brain to deal with it. And sometimes what they'll do is just have somebody else move the leg, or there are even robots these days that will move the leg because it
That's
gets boring
right.
and difficult for the physical therapist. You know?
That's right.
But, yeah, there are some really remarkable robot things that will help people recover from strokes and this kind of injury.
And that
so
brings up that the importance of repetition. We often,
yeah,
when
so
you say even a PT
keep moving
can
that
get
leg, then, it,
mm-hmm.
then it's like the wiring kind of takes hold from the other end. You know, move leg, move leg, move leg. Oh, there's supposed to be a signal connected in here somewhere. Where are we going to connect that signal? You know, and the brain will eventually figure that out. It's
That's
not
right.
a quick process, but if we keep at it, because as you say, in the old days they used to say a year and that's it, so people would give up. But if you give up, then it definitely won't happen. But if you keep at it, it just might.
That's right. And you can get very tired of practicing at home, so you have to keep coming up with ways to keep it fresh. But it counts a lot. I saw Alan make a lot of practice by a lot of progress from practicing both motor skills and reading, which was the thing that mattered the most in the world to him. And his whole quality of life revolved around being able to communicate and being able to read. And he did get back to reading at maybe a third grade level, which he practiced every day and enjoyed doing. He read out loud for hours at a time. He volunteered at a preschool near us, reading stories to children. There are so many ways to go about
Great.
Whatever gives your life meaning.
Sure. So give us some insights into that process. So learning to read again. And here's
yeah.
an award-winning physicist and educator from Northeastern University who suddenly is having to learn to read again.
Right.
So how did you approach that?
It was an amazing process to watch. He didn't know the alphabet. He didn't recognize letters. But he would, and when he spoke, all of these functions are very related in the brain. He would talk gibberish at first with an occasional word thrown in, but he was desperate to communicate. So one of the ways that it started were that the speech-language pathologist, SLP it's called, and they just do the most amazing work with retraining the brain, would write out the letters of the alphabet on a piece of paper. And Alan would painstakingly carve over them with his pencil, you know, tracing the letters. The next step was that she wrote the letters with a set of dashes, and then he kind of connected the dash to form the letter, and then worked up to writing the letter underneath what she had written, copying the letter. I mean, this took weeks and weeks of work, and he and I practiced for hours a day after the hour-long session he had with the speech-language pathologist. Then we sang that alphabet song that children learn over and over. We called it the soundtrack to our days, the A, B, C, D, E, F, G. We sang that together all day long. And a real peak of his rehabilitation was about 8 weeks after the brain injury. I walked into his hospital room at 8 a.m., and he sprang off the bed and sang A, B, C, D, E, F, G, all the way to the end with no mistakes. Now, I considered
Yay.
That. I was never more proud of my husband. I really mean that. And I considered
yeah.
that the equivalent of taking a master's level science course, you know, for the effort that took. And then once he did that, he could start to try to read simple sentences. And at one point, I knew he had to do this, but I was waiting for him to be ready. He said, go get first grade books. And so I did.
Right.
And we had a dog that Alan loved, so I bought a book called My Dog's the Best. It was like a first-grade reader. And we Indeed. Practiced that for hours a day, sounding out the words. And he read like a child does, you know, totally
yeah.
flat,
yeah.
no intonation. It was just amazing to listen to. And then we made a list of the hard words in the book so he could practice sounding them out and saying it. Learning to read as an adult is a different process than as a child, they explained to me. But again, the practice. And so he finally aced My Dog's the Best and could read it all the way through. And I framed it and hung it on our bedroom wall, you know, because that was his comeback book. And
no,
you have to
for sure.
celebrate these things. You know, it sounds strange because you're teaching an adult something a child learns to do, but man, they're just such huge accomplishments that it really, you need to appreciate them for all they are worth.
Absolutely. So it sounds like step number one is to reset your expectations.
That's
on both
right.
sides. And
keep it very
and
realistic
choose,
and slow.
Choose realistic goals. And as you say, reading is a very complex art, so is speaking. And just decoding those symbols, taking those dots and dashes and whatever and assembling them into letters and then translating that into a sound,
mm-hmm.
It's really a very complex process in our brains. We don't realize how complex. We kind of take it for granted because we've been doing it our whole lives.
That's right.
But when you have to start over from scratch, you realize just how complex it is and how long it takes to build up that tower of complexity.
And someone has to be very motivated to keep practicing. And this is a big problem for many people with brain injury, and it's not a personality flaw or that they don't want to try. It has to do with injuries to different parts of the brain where they can have a sort of apathy or lack of motivation that makes it even harder to engage them and have them drive themselves to practice these things 1,000 times. We were fortunate in that although Alan had many sorts of injuries, he never lost his curiosity or his willingness to keep doing something over and over. And that was a godsend for us.
Right. Now, which professionals were the most helpful to you in getting through those early days and trying to work out a plan that was going to get you out of the basement?
Yes, I think in rehabilitation, there was a wonderful team at Spalding Rehab. You know, there was a physician, there were wonderful nurses. The people we worked with the closest were the speech-language pathologist who worked on all of the brain functions, starting with attention, concentration, you know, building that up for weeks before Alan could even try to learn to read. The occupational therapist addressed learning all the basic skills again, how to put on clothes in the right order, which was totally foreign to him. He would step into his T-shirt and pull it up like pants, because when nothing makes sense to you, you don't know where to start. So the occupational therapist taught us all of those basic, what they call ADLs, or activities of daily living. And the physical therapist taught Alan how to start balancing again and then how to walk again because he lost that ability. That came back very quickly. The biggest advantage we had was that they each trained me to understand the principles and specifics of everything they were doing with Alan so that I could practice it with him for hours afterwards during the day. And then when we came home, that was very important. And a neuropsychologist was great. He did the evaluation that identified what parts of Alan's brain weren't functioning well, what parts were most affected so they could prioritize the treatment, and what parts still had some strengths, so because you want to build on whatever strength the person has.
Right.
And he also worked with us on a lot of the behavioral issues that are very common after brain injury. I mentioned the agitation and anxiety when you can't understand anything around you, can't control your emotions. He was also very helpful with disinhibition when someone's had a brain injury. In the very early stages, they don't have any filters in their brain, so they'll say and do anything that comes into their mind. You know, Alan was constantly trying to run away from the hospital, which a lot of patients do. They just want to go home. They don't think there's anything wrong with them. They don't need to be here. Let me go home. And he worked with us on engaging Alan in his own priorities, which for Alan were walking and reading again, and so that he would want to stay. He had no choice, but he didn't know that at the time.
Right.
So the neuropsychologist was also tremendously helpful in outlining what direction the treatment should go in. But it takes a team. That's my main point. It takes a team of skilled professionals in rehabilitation to get someone the best care possible for as early and as long as possible.
I've read in the press that the returning vets don't always get the analysis of this through in normal course of doing business when they return. So if you're a spouse of someone who's returned and you're sensing these kinds of issues, they must be relatively mild if they haven't been picked up yet. But nonetheless, what's the best way to approach trying to get some assistance for your spouse and, of course, for yourself? Because this is, as you outlined, not something that a willing spouse can deal with by him or herself.
No, nor should they. And part of the problem is that some of the manifestations of milder forms of brain injury don't come out right away. So it may be, you know, days, weeks, even months later when the person starts to have trouble with impulse control or concentration or not being able to do the job that they did, or they're yelling at the children all the time because they have no patience and don't know what to expect from the children anymore. The main part is that you don't give up. You know that there's a problem, and you keep going through the channels and to higher channels to get the attention that you need. And this can be a big problem because when it's brain injury is called the silent epidemic, because people often look very normal, and a lot of even medical providers aren't as skilled as they should be in recognizing and believing the early manifestations. So what the caregiver has to do is not give up, not take no for an answer, keep going through the system and demanding that there be a further evaluation. Call local resources. In the military, there's a really wonderful system now called DIVBIC. It's the Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center, and their website is www.dvbic.org. I think it's .org or .com. And they have a lot of information about how to get services if you're in the military, and a lot of information about recognizing brain injury, how to deal with it at home. They have a whole section for caregivers, and for someone who's had a mild to moderate brain injury, they have a whole 6-lesson educational program for caregivers that I think should be a national model for everybody. So that's
great.
It is a great resource.
DIV.
It's Defense and Veterans Brain Injury Center. So DVBIC.
Right. And
I believe
and
it's dot org.
In particular for the right, and look in particular for the advice on where you can get help, and there is some online assistance in doing some self-evaluation at home that might be all you need if it's truly mild, but might lead you to better resources if you need more help.
Right, and an important part about getting an official professional opinion of brain injury is that you want it documented early, because even if you recognize that you've had a concussion and you rest for a while and then you feel all right, part of the problem can be that there can be problems months down the line, or you may develop some cognitive problem and need a neuropsych evaluation. But if nobody has documented that the injury happened and you were first evaluated and maybe had a CAT scan of your head, then it can be harder to file the claim and get access to the treatment you absolutely deserve and need if you haven't claimed it in the very beginning. So it's good to just establish that baseline. And it also gives you an examination that future treaters can go back to compare, you know, has this become better or worse, or do we now need to worry about this area? So it's always good to get a professional opinion as soon as you can.
Right, and get that baseline evaluation, as you said, so if it's 6 months from now or whatever, you can look at it again and determine whether it's in fact better or worse. And
that's right.
Better would be cheering, and worse would be, okay, we need more help, we need a different kind of help. But I think it's very important, especially for people in the military who are so trained to be strong and persistent, is that this is not something that you can deal with by yourself. You really do need some help. It's not a sign of weakness to admit that. It's actually a sign of strength to be going and getting the assistance that you need.
That's absolutely true. And you stand every chance of being restored to very good functioning if you get the help that you need, especially early on.
Right.
And you're not alone. You know, as they say, over 300,000 service members have brain injuries.
Right. But nonetheless, I mean, we have to admit that it can be very draining on a relationship.
Absolutely.
And especially for people who weren't married very long before this person went overseas and then comes back and he's not quite the same guy that you married, it can be very frustrating. So are there support groups for wives or spouses of people who are going through this?
Yes, there are, and it varies from community to community, of course, but people are very attuned to it. One wonderful source that's not military but is doing a lot of outreach to the military is the Well Spouse Association, and that's www.wellspouse.org, and that's a national support organization run by primarily volunteers for any caregiver of a partner or spouse who has a serious illness or a chronic or progressive illness. I found them extremely helpful when Alan had his brain injury. I was very involved with meeting other caregivers, going to conferences and support groups, having an online forum. And Well Spouse is doing a lot to reach out to military caregivers now also. And the military has also set up lots of support groups. And state brain injury associations have lists of all the support groups throughout that state. If you go to www.biaa.org, that's the Brain Injury Association national website, they have links to all the state organizations. So there are many resources for caregivers, and it's so important to get support and help, especially support. I always think the best kind of support is a combination of being allowed to express all the emotions that you're going through, but also that it have a constructive part to it where other people help you learn the skills that you need, because they vary over the course of the years of taking care of someone. But other people can help you learn the skills so that you can keep moving on both as a caregiver and in your own life.
Right. And even if you're housebound with your spouse for a while, a lot of this is available over the Internet, right?
That's right. There are so many wonderful online forums, both through Well Spouse has it, some brain injury associations have it, and if you just Google caregiver online support, there are probably hundreds of forums for caregivers.
Yeah,
that
you
is a big
become
issue.
A little more helpful than others, but you've given
that's
us
right.
Good references here.
That's right. I favor the ones that are moderated or the support groups that do have a facilitator who's trained in what the issues are and in group dynamics and can help people not to get stuck or just vent in unproductive ways for long periods of time.
Right, because it is a situation that leads to a lot of frustration, both for the patient and for the family people around them. And so, as you say, it helps to be able to let off some steam once in a while, but then you have to turn that constructive and say, okay, you've had your pity party, as it
right.
goes. But now, okay, so what's the plan? What are the next steps? How are we going to get unstuck?
Right. What's the information you need to be able to move ahead in this? Or, you know, what advocacy have you tried that's worked? Okay, what else can we try? What can you do to get some respite for yourself, which is a constant issue for caregivers? You know, can you let someone else help you take care? Can you find a program where your loved one can spend 3 or 4 days as an inpatient so you can go away? Oftentimes it's caregivers who can say to each other, you know, we really need to take better care of ourselves. We've gotten into such a habit of giving our all and being self-sacrificing, but to maintain our own health, which is a huge issue for caregivers, there are steps that we need to take, including regular respite breaks away from the house.
Yeah, one of the analogies that I like is when you go on an airplane, And the stewardess says, no, if those little oxygen masks come down, you put your own mask on first before you help anybody else, including your child.
That's
and
right.
I was traveling with one of my grandsons at that time, and Ryan turned to me and he said, why would you put your mask on first and not mine?
Ah.
And I said, well, you know, if I pass out, then I won't be able to help you at all. So
that's right. That's exactly right. And as time
and
goes on.
It is the challenge for caregivers, is not only do we want to take care of the person that we love, but we must take care of ourselves or we won't even be there for that person.
Right. And I think the most important reason to take care of ourselves is that we deserve it as a valuable human being. I think particularly when you've been a caregiver for a long time, the medical professionals and even other people in your social circle start to look at you as just an appendage of the sick person who lives and whose only mission in life is to take care of that person. You can lose your own identity and sense of worth aside from the caregiver role. So I'm a support group facilitator. I have been for many years for people who have family members with brain injury. And I always say, well, the first reason to take care of ourselves is we deserve it as valuable human beings who have a responsibility to ourselves. Second, because this other person is so dependent on us.
Right. Very well said. Thank you. Great. So there is hope for this. There's more hope now than we've ever had before for brain injury. We understand it better. We appreciate it more. The medical profession is appreciating it. And even, actually, the military is appreciating it because they used to call this malingering, you know.
Right.
That if somebody got shell-shocked or whatever and didn't want to go back on the front lines, that they were just, you know, not doing the right thing. Now they understand that the brain really does need a little time out here to recoup its forces. And we're learning more tricks, too, about how to help the brain recover from this kind of thing. So it is something that something can be done about, but probably not by you and your loved one at home.
Not right away. You need a lot of training from professionals in order to do that. But then it does become the responsibility of the caregiver to provide rehab for many years. And I always advocate that we need more resources like coaching and skill building coaches who could come into the house and show us new ways of doing things when you've been a caregiver for years and someone develops a new behavior problem or you want to take their cognitive functioning a step further. I think we need a lot more provisions for that in health insurance and in rehabilitation coverage that years later someone will come and instruct the caregiver how to take things a step further or address a new problem.
Right. Now, you mentioned, too, that one has to renegotiate roles and responsibilities with one's spouse when
Yes. This
kind of a situation comes up, and that's not always so easy to do. Can you give us some words of wisdom in that vicinity?
Yes, I think one thing you have to do is be realistic about what a person's capabilities are, and at the same time, make sure you still treat them as an adult. It's very easy when someone's had a brain injury and you've watched them go through rehab to really treat them like a child, talk to them like a child, take care of them like a child. You have to give somebody as much independence as they can safely handle and let them keep growing, but at the same time, they may never go back to doing some of the more complicated responsibilities like managing finances or doing home repairs or going back to a higher level type of employment like they had before. So again, some of that involves grieving the losses that are involved, but finding other ways to get those things done. Be realistic about how much you can take on and not a bit more. It's wonderful to have a circle of support where everyone who's been involved with that family comes together to organize a plan to pick up the slack, to do a lot of the household chores, to participate in childcare, transportation, arranging meals, even helping with the rehabilitation. Someone comes in and helps to do exercises for physical therapy. So when the two people in the close relationship, say a husband and wife, can no longer do that, having a circle of support that's a committed group that divides up tasks every week or every month to pick up some of what can no longer be done by those people can be very helpful. But sometimes that involves the caregiver saying, well, we can't do this anymore, or I just have to let this go, and either let it go forever, doesn't matter that much, you know, often how many times you clean certain rooms of your house, but other things that do need to be taken care of, like arranging for the children to still be able to participate in sports. Well, that means that one of the other parents arranges to pick them up and bring them out for snacks with everyone afterwards and bring them home. So having that circle of support is extremely important. And one thing that really suffers is mutuality, particularly in a marriage. You know, we take that for granted because we wouldn't marry someone we didn't have a sense of mutual sharing, expectations, kindness, empathy for each other. But after brain injury, that person may not be capable of mutuality again. Alan was not, at least in anywhere near the same degree or way. So I had to develop mutuality in other relationships with close friends, that people who knew me very well and I knew them, and we could help each other out in different situations, confide in each other, have some intimacy that way. So seeking mutuality in other relationships can also be important when someone can't take on their roles again.
Right, and being willing to accept that help. Sometimes your neighbors or your friends will say, well, what can I do to help? And people's first response tends to be, oh, that's all right. I mean,
right.
I can sort of manage. But you can't always manage. And if they brought you just one hot meal a week, or if they drove the kids to the soccer practice, or, you know, find some little thing that's realistic to ask of them and accept the help. It's actually a privilege for your friend, and it makes them feel good if they get to assist in some way.
That's right. And don't feel guilty if it goes on for a long time. We start to say, oh, people have been so kind to us during the months he was in the hospital. They did so much. I don't want to ask them. But meanwhile, I'm drowning at home, and it's now
right.
been 2 years. Don't feel guilty. As you say, people really respond, well, you may need to involve some new people. Maybe some of the original
mm-hmm.
ones have done as much as they can. They have their own life issues. But involve some new people or reach out in different ways. But don't feel guilty about it. And think broadly. At first, I was focused on only wanting people to come in and spend time with Alan because he couldn't be left alone. He just couldn't be safe alone. So I could go out and take a walk or do an errand. But a lot of people didn't feel comfortable. Why should they? You know, someone just home from brain injury rehab who's learning to communicate
right.
again. So I had to think more broadly. So I came up with a long list. Well, if someone could cut the lawn, trim the hedges, walk the dog, you know, that would be terrific. And people jumped
yeah.
in to do those things. They were too nervous and inexperienced. I was asking them to do something totally out of their own experience to come and spend time with Alan, but they couldn't wait. Another friend came in one day while we were in the hospital and scrubbed my stove. I still remember coming home to this gleaming white new stove. And I never would have thought of that, but wow, does that look great and make me feel good, you know? So creative about all the things you can ask for or offer to somebody who is a caregiver.
Right, right. Well, Janet, this has been delightful. Thank you so much for joining us today. And are there other things that you particularly would like to share with our audience before we close?
Yes, Joyce, thank you. On my website, janetcromer.com, I have many resources as well as many tip sheets I've written for caregivers about doing rehabilitation at home, about taking care of yourself across the long continuum, and a lot more information about the book, Professor Cromer Learns to Read. I also write a weekly blog that's most specifically for caregivers, and it's on the website.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It gives, if there's one thing that this requires above all, it's patience.
That's
and,
right.
And it's very easy to run out of patience. So
you take a lot of deep breaths.
Care of yourself.
That's right. Take a lot of deep breaths, but laugh a lot. Laugh every chance you get. That helps, too.
Right. That's a great idea. So, well, and your husband's doing well now?
Well, Alan had that severe heart attack that led to the brain injury. We didn't know he had such heart disease before, but he did die of heart disease 7 years after this happened. This happened in 1998, and he died of heart disease in 2005. But I say that he lived 7 years after a fatal heart attack and made a whole new life with a lot of purpose and meaning to it.
And really left a rich legacy, and you're really doing a great job in sharing that legacy with all of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joyce.
Okay, thank you, Janet Cromer, and don't forget to go to janetcromer.com to get some of the good information that she shared with us. I'll put the other URLs into the fact sheet that goes with the show. So if you look at powerfulpatient.org, it'll take us a day or two to get it moved over there. But the long-term storage of this show will be at powerfulpatient.org. And thank you very much to Janet Cromer. And thank you, everybody, for being with us. We hope that you'll have a great week. We're going to skip this Thursday because I'm going to be in Cincinnati. And I will see you next week with another show. And I hope that you all will be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you so much.